Gideon willed herself to pass out as Crux's cold, bony fingers closed around one of her ankles. It nearly worked. She woke up a few times to blink at the monotonous light that illuminated the lift down to the bottom of the main shaft, and stayed awake when the marshal dragged her like a sack of rotten goods across the bottom of the tier. She felt nothing, not pain, not anger, not disappointment. Just a curious sense of wonder and disconnect as she was hauled bodily through the doors of Druidbur. She stirred to life for one last escape attempt, but when he saw her scrabbling at the threadbare carpets on the slick, dark floor, Crux kicked her in the head. Then she did pass out for a little while, for real, only waking up when she was heaped onto a forward pew. The pew was so cold, her skin stuck to it, and each breath was like needles in the lung. You're listening to Nunpod with Left Grief, Episode 3, Muster Call.
Each breath like needles in the lung. That's such a real fucking feeling. You grew up on the East Coast. You also know about weather.
I've also had pneumonia, and it feels like that. That's what it feels like.
Everything's kind of rattly and stabby and sizzles in the worst way on the way in.
Yeah.
I keep on using snow leaks and their like biome and climatic zone.
It's warm enough to be growing food.
But it's cold enough that it's a very specific type of food. You can't grow salad leafy greens, but if it lives below the ground and you don't mind if it grows really slowly, you're okay. So you can grow like kale during the winter. You can grow carrots, potatoes.
Obviously, in the last chapter, Harrow dug a lot. So we're not looking at the kind of like permafrost ground situation. So I guess they have warmed up the planet or warmed up this part of the planet or something. Obviously, it's still very cold, but Pluto's surface temperature is around negative 400 Fahrenheit, negative 230 Celsius.
So the atmosphere, the artificial atmosphere systems must also include a temperature regulation that goes at least to some degree into the soil. Or there's some kind of top layer that has been brought in and dropped down that has maybe a thermal substrate that's going to keep it insulated from the frozen ground.
Yeah, I think a thermal substrate would make a lot of sense.
There are some beautiful ways in which the Locked Tomb series is kind of solar punky. Like the technology we're discussing here is basically we're like, Mir has given us a scene, and we're saying, what do we know that would make this plausible? And developing agricultural concepts and practices based on these kind of creative scenarios, like, is actually kind of fun. And living in a cooler climate, like, solar punk isn't always just temperate. Solar punk is also recognizing that you want to be able to grow food crops outside of friendly climatic zones.
There are skeletons at the church service, which seems to be a really interesting departure from how we've been discussing the skeletons as being very instrumentalized. Like on its surface, there's no benefit to them. They're not having a spiritual experience. They're not having an experience. Necromancers are piloting the skeletons into church to have them sit in church and play church. That is a wild cultural performance.
What is it accomplishing?
It seems like the thing that it's accomplishing is making the community seem bigger and making the skeletons seem like they're still part of the community.
So I would think that that would be something that emerged more recently out of a reaction to the sudden loss or gradual and sudden loss over time of community and the weakening of the ninth as an identity. This is a muster call. So the necromancers who are piloting those skeletons are assumably also here.
Sure.
And they, reasonably, as living people, would be expected to anything that a living person would be expected to be at. But the idea that you also bring along your tools to church because morale, because your tools happen to be person-shaped,
And the
is
skeletons aren't just, they're not deposited at the back. They're not just standing waiting. It's not that they've stopped work so that the necromancers can focus on the muster call. They're sitting in the pews. They're pretending to do church. It kind of seems like that is a gesture, like an exculpatory gesture, that we're not profaning the bodies of the dead. They're like still doing holiness.
We talk a lot about high control and tradition. That's a great example where it's like, cool, just assume that your bones will still be going on Sunday. That tracks. And that still accomplishes that level of we're a community. Even when you know that these are your tools, I think the part of your brain that says a skeleton is a person, that's very, in my feeling, a hardwired thing. That's why we have the uncanny valley effect. We're very aware of what a human is, even if we're instrumentalizing that human being.
Totally.
From the first example of active necromancy, we have this idea that it's a very active, hands-on kind of thing. But we later on have examples of like reactive necromancy. So the idea that there's a kind of a programmable sequence that you could put into something isn't that far of a stretch of the imagination. It's more of a technology. Again, it doesn't treat it like it's woo magic. It treats it like it's technology.
I think
So
that's
I.
right, though. It raises questions about the granularity of control
Yeah.
of non-harrow, non-first skeletons. Like, we know that people have to drive them, but we don't know how close attention, how minute that actually is.
We can look at the complexity of programming that we have now. We're recording this in July of 2025. We are into the era where the larger public is having to reckon with what their idea of AI is and how it's going to affect their life. We've had the concept of AI and complex problem-solving programming in various different respects for quite a long time. I am assuming that we have the same variety of programming of necromancy available to us, and that it is very possible that necromancy also, I mean, we have examples in this book where it also pushes the bounds of acceptability. But this is clearly extremely mundane. There is no discourse necessary within day-to-day life about whether or not this is cool or not.
If it's the case that there's a sort of set it and forget it to the Dürer skeletons, that ultimately there's a human supervising them, but on a day-to-day level they're sort of running a set program, then their presence in ritual and religious practice would almost serve to help the community forget that they are objects, because they would appear to be autonomous. They would appear to be participating. And even though everybody understands, technologically that that's not what's happening, it might make it easier to deal with the fact that grandma is doing snow leaks now, because grandma is also praying and she loved to pray.
Yeah, and I'm reaching for, real life examples of where we have accepted and normalized instrumentalization of friends and family and our community members. And I'm like, the one that comes to mind the most is like the emotional distance from the working conditions of people who are do like Lyft and Uber driving. Because of the distance technology-wise between the immediate interpersonal experience of paying someone for their time, we have no idea what their actual lived experience is, but we assume, given that both of us maintain normal social interactions during our exposure to each other, that, oh, everything's fine. But that's our practicing protocol.
Yeah, going back to the W.E.B. Du Bois studies that we mentioned in the first episode, the rituals of social deference help convince the controlling class that everything is good and everyone's happy. And it seems like having these skeletons appear to participate in religious life suggests that their afterlives have meaning and dignity.
Yeah. So the seating in the church is clearly explicitly set out by social status.
Yeah, we've got the high-ranking leadership up front, and then it sounds like it's like humans up front, skeletons in the back.
Yeah, that would make sense.
I imagine that Gideon doesn't normally sit in the front row, and she's only been put in the front row as part of making sure that Ordis gets to the shuttle first.
Yeah, it does seem like her observations of the different individuals that she can see from where she is has a degree of like, oh, like there's a novelty to it.
We also, it's been suggested at least that she has been avoiding services, which it's interesting that she's been allowed to avoid services, and it's possible that indentured servants who don't have religious status don't always go to services, but I would assume that space Catholics, everybody gotta pray.
Catholics. Yeah. Though escape attempts are a thing, and I could see Harrow getting bored with the tier of truancy and being like, fine, I'll intervene and fuck with you when you try to escape, because like doing this every single week, assuming a weekly observation,
I
might get
assume
bored.
daily prayers. I
Daily prayers.
So Catholics have holy hours, and there are specific prayers that happen at specific hours, and there are like major and minor hours, and the major hours they are like gathering together and praying together in a monastic community, and then the minor hours is like praying by yourself, quiet contemplation. And so because of the specific pattern of the bell that's rung, I believe it is the equivalent of 6 a.m.
Yeah, Secundarius Bell is the one mentioned, right?
Secundarius is going to happen. Secundarius is going to happen.
Okay.
This is literally prime, the
Right.
first hour of daylight, which daylight isn't exactly what we're experiencing because of the planet that we're on, but prime is the first hour, and there's a codified meaning for how the bells are rung, and I don't know a lot about it, but the specific bell that's described in the previous chapters is the Angelus pattern, which is used for a call to prayer. So I assume that there's a call to prayer every morning at 6, equivalent of 6 a.m., equivalent of noon, equivalent of 6 p.m. Obviously, the actual timing is weird because 253 hour day, but I'm assuming that there are 3 hours of the day when basically the whole community is gathering to pray together. So, as Gideon is sitting in Dreerbur and seeing people and paying attention to this unusual vantage point, she is especially noticing Ordis, who we have seen some references to in earlier chapters, but this is our first kind of major view of Ordis.
Or, like Ordis just evokes feelings of like I want to hug you, like I just want to give this soft sweet man a hug, because like those that's most of my feelings. But at the same time, I noticed a lot of the language, because she takes a lot of pains to describe him physically, and similarly to this is a world that never bothered with racism and homophobia. This is a world that doesn't bother with fat phobia.
I disagree. I'm
Okay.
uncomfortable with how she talks about Ordis's body, and
Okay.
I feel like the way that necromancers are very skinny in a sickly way,
Power and thinness.
but thinness is also highly kind of prized because I feel that there's some
I,
like
yeah.
tubercular waifishness kind of happening in this world, and so his fatness is a sign of his powerlessness, and his fatness is a sign
Yes.
of his lack of mastery over the body, which I hope that Tamsin Muir is doing something on purpose, but I worry that she's not.
I see what you mean, and I think the thing that really drives that home is the way that Ordis's father is described, who is basically implied to be that like Ordis's physical frame comes from his father's physical frame. Ordis is built like a brick house, and like Ordis's dad was built like a two-story brick house, but Ordis's dad gets panniers full of fibulae, and Ordis feels like he's wilting. You're right. Mortis has that mastery over the body language that Ordis is conspicuously, repeatedly conspicuously not given.
He is the only character who is explicitly described as fat, and he is also the only character who is described as awkward and who seems to be unsure of what to do with the mass of his body and to sort of never fit in. And so we see him having like weird experiences with chairs, which as a fat person, that's real. That's a real experience.
Yeah.
But it illustrates his character in a way that I'm like, Yeah, I think it's well meant, but I think it's a missed.
Yeah.
And it's one reason that I go so hard as a headcanon for Fat Corona Beth, because Corona is so self-possessed and so comfortable in her body,
Yeah.
despite the fact that it is not a necromancer body. And so I.
My imagination of how Corona Beth is and embodies herself is like somewhere between Rose Quartz and Jessica Rabbit, but like as a big thick lady, there is something really, really lovely in seeing someone who's just like fully inhaled in their presence. There's no small breath.
I love how Lady Pelumina and Lord Primehark are introduced, because it's such a beautiful example of how Tamsin Muir uses language in a way that suggests that it's being metaphorical or symbolic, and then you find out either immediately or way later that it's literal. We're given information that we immediately misinterpret about them. It sets it up immediately that their faces haven't changed since the last time Gideon sees them. And so the immediate mental connection you make is like, oh, these are older people who are aging pretty well. That, you know, it's maybe it's been a little bit of time since Gideon has seen them in person, and so she might have expected them to look older, but they're not. They're perfectly well preserved.
Priam's jaw was still firm, his shoulder unstooped, his brow clear and unlined. They were utterly unchanged, less changed even than the shitty great aunts. This was because they'd been both been dead for years.
Yeah, I love that this
Buffs.
paragraph sets it up like they're not aging because they're dead.
Yeah. I think that is a very distinct rhythm of her writing, where it's like set up, set up, set up, boom, where it's like it happens in the following paragraph, where it's like she hadn't executed very well. Her parents were fine from the shoulders up, but from the shoulders down, they were bad, though she had admittedly been 10. And that's the style of her writing at large, too, where it's like you're going to be given this impression, and then we're going to subvert it in a way that lands like a thunk. This is fucking troll behavior. Every paragraph is her trolling us at a small level so she can troll us at the large level, and we know and love it. But this is what it is. It's I know how you're going to be perceiving these three parts, and part number four, you will feel upset at realizing how you have been deceived.
She's doing a Harrow Hark Nona Jessamis to us, the reader.
Ah! Shout out to the phrase mega dead.
Megadeth, very good.
This is my first thorough reread after really having it drilled into me just the degree of first personness that this is written in. When I first read these books, I was like, we're reading in narration, blah blah blah, just kind of walking along, not really aware of what a detailed, intentional first person narration is offering. Like, this is not just someone's running narrative. This is someone's beliefs. This is someone's values. This is someone's shortcomings. This is someone's pitfalls that they've put in their own mind. This is a whole bunch of things. This is someone's age. Mega dead.
Yeah, we have such a powerful sense of voice on Gideon and on Tamsin Muir herself, and it is so delightful.
Yeah, it is really lovely, and now knowing that that's present here, I get to notice it so much more.
Yeah, I feel like you don't notice how powerful the voice is in Gideon until you read Harrow.
Yeah, you know that she had admittedly been 10 is immediately followed by a lot of allusion that is just like we don't talk about how bad it is. Like we don't even think out loud. We don't even think to ourselves about what happened. Level
Gideon
of
is having incoherent thoughts about what happened that tells us, yes, that it's awful and that she's internally making jokes about it, but that she is still not making eye contact with it.
Yeah. And she's stuck in it until Harrow speaks. It activates her and she gets lost in her coping.
And maybe that's actually why she doesn't go to church, and maybe that's why Harrow lets her not go. Because maybe Harrow feels a little on edge watching Gideon stare at her dead parents.
Fuck.
Maybe everybody has to go to church except Gideon, because Gideon can't fucking behave.
Oh, okay. We will absolutely get more into that when we talk more about Harrow's parents in more detail and the awful, awful secret.
Harrowhark Nonagesimus receives a summons.
All prayer beads stop. I am again obsessed with the sensory stuff talking that it's talked about, where it's like we go from this lighting effect with this like ambient clackety sound to silence. And she stand does she stand up to for this? Did she take a movement in doing so, or is she standing this whole time?
She is rising to stand. Yeah,
She
she.
rises to stand. The vibes in the room are lifting. There's all this more language of it being upping.
Yeah, their soft cries of joy, their exclamations of praise and thankfulness, which is such a big departure from the silent prayer.
Which is immediately undermined by the following sentence of Gideon's cynicism, which is fair and I'm sure well-informed cynicism, but it's like this is not Gideon's thankfulness. This is not Gideon's sound of praise and joy.
Gideon also has a just banger of a headache right now.
Right.
She is a little extra sour, I think, because her head is ringing. She just got her clock cleaned.
Yeah. Harrow is now reciting this letter, and she gives a lot of she really likes the performance. She loves the bit. She loves her idea of her performance being part of who she is. And she's like, this is a great example of how emotional she is. She is intentionally high drama in a way that like her parents were cold. This is mentioned in this chapter. Her parents don't have this very dramatic ways of interacting. Harrow could put a lot less work into this, and still everything would go the way she wants it to. But for her, the performance is really important. So this is Harrow trying to step in and be like, I'm a big grown-up. Look at how much I know about being.
I think it's partly that. I think there's a little bit of overacting in how important it is to her to not get caught, and that sometimes lead to overacting, particularly for young folks. And I think also she is a little bit of a theater kid. She has that poetry in her. She has that literary spirit. When we hear her speak later in, more intimate and less scripted ways, and even in the last chapter, she is a dramatic person.
Yeah. She's dramatic and she wants people to know that she's smarter than them.
Yeah, she does.
And so she that's always kind of like a little bit of a lacing on the way she delivers, which I think Gideon loves to hate. It like absolutely is the thing that drives Gideon up the fucking wall.
And Gideon also wants to be the best and wants to be recognized as the best. And
Yeah. I've worked with a couple of kids that had a lovely friendship, but also had that each of them wanted to be the best. And the amount of like fucking effort that requires, like from both of them to each other, not even to speak of from me as their teacher, but like the high maintenance of I love you and also I need to be better than you and you need to acknowledge it. Like that is such an intense dynamic in a friendship. And seeing other people as a threat to your sense of like psychological resource and scarcity, you're just like, no, if you're good at something, I'm in danger.
And I think that sense of threat and scarcity is why Harrow is so able to recognize that Gideon is good at swords, but also treats her like she's stupid. Because Gideon's
Yeah.
not stupid, but Gideon is, to a pretty significant degree, convinced that she's stupid because Harrow needs her to think that she's stupid.
Yeah. And there's like a real satisfaction that Harrow gets every time that Gideon doubts herself. Like there's a kind of savoring when she's like, ha ha ha, you fell into my little trap. I need you to fall into my trap even more. Keep falling, keep doing it. Keep like it's not even like there's not even a full confidence in her own self. She's like, I need Gideon to show me how smart I am because I need to know how much smarter I am than Gideon.
Yeah,
There was
Harrow
never a
also
time where
wants
Harrow
Ordis
took.
to be stupid.
Yeah. There was never a second where Harrow really took Ordis seriously or gave him any deference or respect.
Someone dies in the middle of church.
Everyone here is really old, and it makes for a very bleak but also like resigned energy because they just go right back to it. It's not a big fucking deal that someone just dropped dead.
And in fact, it says everyone around him celebrated his sacred good fortune.
There's when Harrow reads the summons and, Glarika's like, not my baby. She says this phrasing that I think is a little interesting. And when you look at the punctuation too, it's also interesting. I gave you my husband, hyphen, Lord Nonivania, Mortis, I gave you my spouse. Lord Mortis, do you demand my son of me? Do you demand my son? Surely not now. Is she speaking to her dead husband? Because it's also ambiguous whether she's speaking to Harrow or her dead husband. Glorica is terrified at that, but there seems to be a thing where she's not actually blaming Harrow for it. She's blaming Mortis.
Nonius Vianus is Primarch. She's talking to Harrow's father because she doesn't know that Harrow's in charge.
Thank you. Again, one of those. Okay, this is showing us who knows what.
Yes. So she doesn't know that the Lord and Lady are dead. And I think it says in this chapter, yeah, at the bottom of 37, as Gideon knew and the marshal and the captain of the guard and nobody else in the universe, they were dead. So obviously, and Harrow knows. So she doesn't know. And I think it's interesting that she addresses Primarch and not Peliamina because Harrow always treats Peliamina as the seat of power.
Yeah.
But Primarch is who Glorica addresses. And I think it kind of suggests other places that Mortis was Primarch's cavalier rather than Peliamina's. And so the way power is set up is a little funky.
Yeah, interesting.
It's not clear to me in the way that Glorica responds to Primarch versus the way that Harrow responds to Peliamina. It's not clear to me sort of whose line the power comes through and who holds the power. I have questions about how Glorica understands Mortis's death, because obviously she recognizes that he's dead. She says, I know the things that befall cavaliers. And Crux says, Mortis welcomed death unflinching. So do we all know that he died by suicide, or do they understand his death as some sort of sacrifice? How do you understand part of that scene, but not the whole scene?
And I think one thing that gives us a little bit of insight into that is Ordis's kind of deadpan discussion of his understanding of it. He's like, I do fear death, my Lady Harrowhawk, he says in his squashed, disheartened voice. Like, he doesn't, like, yes, he's flinching, but what he's also saying is that, like, he's not stunned, he's not alarmed, he's not full of, like, he's just kind of like, I don't want to be here. Like, I'm scared and I don't want to be here. And
Yeah.
it's so resigned, like it's so.
Glorica and Ordis in this scene are violating a massive societal taboo by taking death seriously.
Yeah. And this is enough to the point where it mentions that Gideon is like renewed by how much he is not emotionally invested in this, and this is just like watching ninth bullshit that she feels so removed from, and there's a she's laughing.
Yeah, she doesn't care about the person who died, except that she thinks that it makes Harrow uncomfortable. She doesn't actually care about Mortis's death. She doesn't care about Ordis or his mom's fears. She's just like,
Sometimes I have a question, I'm like, who's the loneliest person on the ninth?
ugh.
Like, poor Ordis. Like, there was two other people who were not geriatric on the ninth, and they think he's a joke. I'm trying to put together the timeline of when all the children died, when Mortis died, and the fact that Glorka doesn't really have an understanding of why either of these happened, but how profoundly traumatizing that would be.
So Ordis was 18 when the crush occurred. And that means he was 28 or 29 when his father died.
In which he would implicitly be put forward as the new person holding that title and put forward as a public figure beside Mr. and Mrs. Ninth, and would be having to maintain that story without knowing what was actually happening for the next 10 years, 8 years, 7 years. Like Ordis does, like one of the things that I'm wondering here, like it says that no one else in the world knows. That's Gideon's perspective. Does Ordis know? Because Ordis might know.
Ordis might know something. He
I
might
feel like,
at least feel like things are weird.
yeah, Ordis
Because
is so close to the center, it would be impossible to fully keep him under.
it does seem like that, because he is that House Cavalier serving a master who is putatively having a vow of silence. Ordis didn't one flesh one end with his Necro, because his Necro was dead. So they never had a proper ceremony. He's not walking two steps behind his Necro. Being in his late 20s by the time his father dies, he would have a very robust understanding of what that relationship is supposed to look like. And he must understand that his relationship to the house is not correct.
I think that's where that resigned tone comes from, where he's like, this is fucked up. No one has told me why, but I do know what story I'm supposed to be playing along with, and I don't like it.
Yeah, and I think part of that, obviously, his father has told him that he's a failure and he's the reason that things are bad, but he must understand that that's not the whole story.
Yeah, he's old enough that and that he's had time to see how he is an anomaly within this pattern, and that can there are lots of big gaps in this story. Glaurika and him stealing the shuttle, is that a thing that would have been like anticipated? Was that like, I know that that's a ruse, but it's also the kind of thing where it is an interesting way that someone is painting a character with a motivation with the hopes that it's believed.
The question that I have is, Harrow presents to Gideon the implication that this all, like her plan from the beginning was for Ordis and Glorica to steal the shuttle. That would mean that, Gideon was put on the front pew specifically because the flow of skeletons would make it hard for her to leave on time and it would delay her in leaving. And that would also mean that somebody in the household would have to have tipped off Glorica that the shuttle was there, because she wouldn't necessarily have access to that knowledge automatically.
Well, Crux escorts them to the sanctuary. Crux is the
Oh.
last one to see them before they leave, which like, and to me that says that Crux is actually the one executing the certainty about whether or not they are actually loose ends. Doesn't it that the shuttle like exploded in space or something? Like that's if I remember correctly.
The shuttle does explode, and we'll repeat this when we get to that chapter. But
Well, yeah.
in chapter one, fucking Tamsin Muir telegraphs that that's gonna happen, because Crux is like, you have to come back to the house, and Gideon says to Crux, tell them my shuttle exploded. She's a
Because
monster.
like, and so is Crux. Crux basically being like, there's this shuttle that you can take, and just giving them hope and possible joy and redemption, and this being like, yeah, you fucking left the ninth, you abandoned your duty to the ninth, you should fucking die in space. Like, that is Crux.
I almost feel like he isn't the one to tip them off, because he wouldn't want to help them escape.
He would do it if Harrow told him to.
It comes back to our unanswered question about gossip. Like, who is the person on the ninth who would be like, did you hear that Gideon tried to escape and there's just a shuttle waiting and she's gonna leave? Maybe the great aunts, because the great aunts were privy to the deal. They saw this all happen. So maybe the great aunts were sitting there next to Glorica being like, did you hear that there was this wild skeleton battle this morning and Gideon is going to get a commission and is going to go to Trentham and there's this shuttle? As soon as we finish here, Gideon's going to get on this shuttle. And Glorica's like, oh, noted.
I also imagine that they can communicate in ways that involve, when you have people who have relationships that old and who like to share, local news, it's either shared in an extremely clipped shorthand or in great extensive rambling detail, and like they wouldn't need to say a lot to pass that message on.
Gideon is massaging sprains from her fingers, which I think is another instance of Townsend Muir giving us language that may or may not be symbolic, because reading this as, a former athlete, I'm like, that ain't how that work. You can't do that. But Gideon is immortal and has healing magic, and so it's possible that she can. And as we brought up, we have questions about whether Gideon is, in fact, force sensitive, and so it's possible that she is playing a very similar game to Harrow played as a child.
Just using a different way of relating to it, given that she thinks of herself as athletic rather than like some kind of
It's
pain
possible.
body bone scientist.
It's possible that Gideon is doing instinctive necromantic healing to herself without realizing that she's doing it.
I've never thought about Gideon as inherently necromantic until, the end of the book. But this is gonna be really interesting. How many of these escape attempts, like how many times has Gideon already died? Is it, and have we been given any information about that? If like Harrow had the language to kind of know what she was doing, but Gideon doesn't. And how long will we be noticing that? And does Gideon ever realize it? Really?
I kind of love the idea of Harrow as the conventional, if supernatural, genius, and Gideon as the idiot savant.
The Kronk and Yzma, like I mean, I have also a cat, two cats who also fit this archetype. It's one of my favorite pairings, and I think it's the thing that I first projected onto them. This is I think it's a very simplistic way of looking at it. It's a way that you can read the books and enjoy it without much more complexity. Being like, this is a fun foil for each other dynamic. The meathead with a heart of gold, with a little bit of sass. You've got the like neurotic little book nerd, and like there's all these different ways that these two archetypes have been painted against each other, and I think my first read of it was very simply an enjoyment of that archetype.
Same. Absolutely. On my first read, I was like, oh, you got the smart one in the himbo. Nice. And as I reread, I'm like, Gideon's not stupid.
One of the things I've really enjoyed about exploring these stories as a cosplayer and like the smart one and the himbo dynamic is the ways in which that took me out of my previous existing senses of self. And this was also as I was exploring cosplay as an art form and like what it does to you as you explore other characters. Like Gideon allowed me to stop being the smart one. I was like, I'm someone who's like, I gotta be the smart one. I gotta have the solutions. I gotta know what's going on and have all the information. And now I'm like, I'm muscly and hot and you want my biceps. There was a whole different energy and I had to spend a lot of time learning to embody that. And it changes the way you think about yourself and parts of yourself that you bring to the surface.
My experience cosplaying Harrow and Mercy really changed my understanding of those characters and made me a lot more sympathetic towards those characters. I hated both of those characters and was hesitant to cosplay them, but having done character work in those characters and inhabited and spent time poking around inside them, I love those characters so deeply and would die for them. But cosplaying Corona Beth not only changed how I understand Corona Beth, but also changed how I understand myself.
I really wasn't talking to you a lot when you were doing Corona Bath, so I look forward to hearing more about that. 'Cause yeah, like your Corona Baths to me showed an a aspects of you that I had never seen before that I was like, damn, like okay, where's this gonna go? Like this is fascinating and beautiful and energetic and like not the person of you that I'd ever seen before. It has transformative effects on people. And sometimes it can cause weird confusion in your interpersonal stuff. Like, if you've ever had the experience of cosplaying a character in partnership with someone else, and those characters have a relationship that is unrelated to your relationship, and there starts to be a blurring effect, like that does things to your understanding of yourself, your pre-existing non-fictional relationship. Like, it involves emotional work that you don't expect to have to do in creating that artwork that you don't budget for.
We used to date, and the week that we broke up, we did John and Mercy for the first time.
We also did Abigail and Magnus.
That's true.
And I'm sure the various like ways that cosplay has impacted our perceptions of each other and our relationship will be something interesting for listeners to scratch at our more personal parts of our lives. But that's the thing that cosplay invites, because you are, once you're in the costume, it's now a much more spontaneous form of expression. You're kind of like trying to embody it, and you, like, yes, very skilled actors can put on a very constructed, designed, engineered performance, but cosplay usually isn't that. Cosplay involves a lot more of like, this is my interpretation of this, and it's very personal.
Yeah.
And so when you have a writer and a world in which all the relationships are kind of fucked up and messy, you're like, hey, friend, do you want to go to a weird place with me? I don't know what's there, but we wear fun outfits.
Yeah. And I do want that.
It's a, I recommend it. I don't remember if I introduced you to Locktomb or not. Do you recall?
I had several people, maybe as many as four people, who tried to bully me into reading the Locked Tomb, and I put up a really good fight. I had other people who were actively trying, like physically putting the book into my hand, physically reading the chapters out loud to me to try to get me hooked in this book, and you
Yep.
were cosplaying at the same time. And we were dating, and
Yes.
you were cosplaying Gideon, and I was seeing you cosplay Gideon. And so for me, I looked at Gideon the Ninth and I went, oh, that's my girlfriend.
That's
So
right.
every piece of fan art about Gideon, every reference to Gideon, I was like, that my girlfriend, that's just my girlfriend. My entire definition of Gideon the Ninth was, I can kiss her sometime.
In a equally very normal way, we were talking about Kiriona and gender last night over dinner, and my brain is like, Kiriona is beyond gender, and Kiriona is really hot, and I was like, I've seen one Kiriona
Oh, is it
cosplay.
mine? Is it?
It's
Thank
yours.
you.
If you haven't seen Hans Kiriona cosplay, Hans cosplays are incredible works of art. They involve levels of skill that constantly leave me in awe, and they're worth seeking out. And I'm going to bully Han into putting pictures of them up on the website because they are incredible. And the Kiriona cosplay is, I think, my favorite of them.
I would really like to get back into working on the Kiriona suit, because my sternum is concave, and so, as I like to say, there's lots of space for activities, and I can do a dimensional chest wound that has 2 inches of visible depth into my chest, where the logic is that's where the bone should be, and my bone isn't over there.
Okay,
And
so when I was like, hey, luminescent powder stuck to nose blood is hot, I think this is the same part of my brain that's like glittery, dimensional, bedazzled, jeweled chest wound with 2 degrees of dimensionality with an elaborate suit cosplay. I'm like, can we just agree that that's hot?
I
Like,
can't agree
beautiful
that that's hot.
artwork,
I can't
beautiful
agree that that's
artwork,
hot.
the beautiful artwork that has come out of this fandom. Like, no wonder we're all so horny. The art is really beautiful and inspiring and emotionally compelling and like physically quite compelling too, because of the degree of not necessarily just body horror. I feel like that oversimplifies it, but the relationship to body and queering of the body in the sense of all of these bodies are not allowed to have a full story of their own. And this like highlights all the ways that that's gross and happens. And then we have all this fan art where we're like, we love you and we love you whole again in your deniedness. And we're gonna see you. And that love for the characters is like, I don't know, it makes them all really hot in the art when that's what the people mean. Like there's ones that are like very neutral or not sexual or hot in the intent of how it's presented, like goofy little cute stuff. But like these characters are all real smoochable.
Yeah, almost all of them. There's a line at the end of the prayer. I pray for the soldiers and adepts far from home and all those parts of the empire that live in unrest and disquiet, that points to the Forever War.
Points to the Forever War. It points to the story that those parts are of the Empire. So it paints a certain belief about those territories, and like just yeah, you gotta assume that it's true to say the science sentence. You know, there isn't really a discussion like so that we have these colonized planets. There isn't really discussion about like previously existing populations. other things that are there. These are often all like, we terraformed and colonized. So the unrest and disquiet is all internal.
As you pointed out, this is not a universe where we have indigenous alien species. All of the humans come from Earth, as far as we understand it, and it is simply two different populations that have come originally from Earth and gone into this space diaspora.
So, like, in some senses, it is the space diaspora is the empire's extension, but it's also like there is no other way of defining these places besides parts of the empire.
John claims sovereignty over everything, and it'll be really exciting to get into the narrative about Blood of Eden and the narrative about the sort of hereditary stain of the space wealthy and why these people deserve to be colonized and warred against.
I wonder, so like Electo was a thing not really known by the people who are reciting these prayers on a regular basis. What is their explanation for the phrasing buried insensate in perpetual west with closed eye and stilled brain?
I think that there's a reference to an idea that this is Satan,
Okay. The
but
monster under the mountain meta thing. Yeah.
the prayer, as you point out, is ambiguous as all get out.
Ambiguous as all get out.
It also reminds me of a little bit of Jewish demonology because there are two demons, and this is going to cause a problem for us later in the series. There are two demons that Jews don't say the name of out loud.
Okay,
And
got
one
it.
of them is a cavalier.
Got it.
So I'm gonna be talking around that because I don't say his name out loud.
Okay, got it. You learn about the things that you don't say before you know what they are. You learn about the like in my family those things take certain shapes, and I didn't know that they had words to describe them until someone was like, let me spill the beans on what your folks are not telling you. But you feel it in your bones, and you inherently know to not look directly at it.
Yeah, and I think that this is one of those situations. I think that we don't say Electo's name out loud. I think her name is taboo. And obviously, we see Lictor's names are taboo in various ways, known and unknown to them.
Yeah.
But I think John doesn't like looking right at what he's done. And this is part of the product of that.
Yeah. A prayer for the needs of the Emperor all giving, the undying king's virtues men. Like, he needs to not look at what he's done. Like, he needs them to repeat this so that he can keep up his self-soothing.
I want to know who wrote this prayer and when.
Yes, I also want to know that.
How old is this prayer?
Yeah, who wrote these rituals? This sentence really sticks to me in terms of multiple meanings. I pray for the needs of the Emperor, all giving the undying king his virtues and his men, specifically with the capital V as virtues. Like, are they referring to the lictors in this, or him as a virtuous figure, our perception of him as a virtuous figure, his capacity at maintaining his own integrity and virtues? Like, who is writing this? What do they want for John? What is their responsibility to him in writing this? Are also questions that I want to tack on to when was this written as well? Has it been rewritten? This idea that things were that have been the same for 10,000 years is, I mean, I've mentioned it multiple times. I'm like, how?
Improbable. Big if true. And we find out pretty soon that this prayer is different from the prayers that they do on other houses.
Yeah. This has Harrow's victory speech. Harrow thinks she's won, but you can still kind of tell that Harrow is scared and doesn't really know what's about to happen and is kind of like, this is her Hail Mary. She has revealed the card that this is a Hail Mary.
This last section after the kind of asterisks is so heartbreaking, setting up this idea that Gideon had never gotten close enough to victory to actually feel heartbroken by defeat.
Oh God. Oh God, it's so hard.
The embodied grief that she's feeling in this moment is so evocative, and the revelation from Harrow that she only found out by complete chance that Gideon had done everything right and was on the verge of success. Ugh, it's so painful.
And it's almost this thing where, like, a child escaping over and over and over again is going to treat some of that like a child, where some of it is a game. She is playing with Harrow. Escaping is part of a game. It is part of make believe. Maybe she never really believed it, but she needed to keep doing it to keep herself fucking sane on the nights, knowing that she would never get out. She was always going to keep trying, and this was her first time of believing it was going to work.
Yeah.
Like, that makes me want to cry.
And we end on this note where Harrowhark repeats back to Gideon the thing Gideon says. Harrowhark says, "Because I completely fucking hate you, no offense."
Their desperate need for each other is so intense. I imagine that, like, Harrow's playing this really fucking cool, but when she found out how close Gideon was getting to actually getting out, like,
Terrifying.
she'd lose the thing that she cared about having power over. Like, I don't, she sees Gerber and the Ninth as her responsibility, and she is very duty oriented, and I respect that, but she doesn't care about having power over the Ninth and Gerber the way she cares about having power over Gideon.
Yeah, I don't think she has any felt sense of power over Gerber because her experience of that is so oriented toward obligation and fear.
I hope for Gideon that she tries to escape in the next book in some way. I don't care if she's redeemed, but I hope that she gets an escape attempt where she gets to feel like she wins. I would accept that. Like, give the kid one win. And break my heart while doing it.
Nunpod with Left Grief is created by Claire Beans and Han Kaley, and edited by Han Kaley. Our music is Only Human by Philip Ayers. Today's cover art is by Han Kaley. Visit us at nunpod.com, that's NUNPOD.com, and get our attention on social media with the hashtag Nunpod. Thanks for listening.